title of this lecture is The Departure from the Biblical View of Government in this country, or in terms of the announcements, the departure or the decline in constitutional government. Now, this obviously implies that there was a form of government from which we have declined. And this implication, of course, is quite valid. We started out in our colonial period as the inheritors of the English medieval Norman and Reformation political philosophy and resultant form of government. If I were to take the time, I would trace this for you again through Pauline Maitland, the Constitutional History of England, Charles Howard McIlwain, the High Court of Parliament, and other such great constitutional treatises of English history, such as William Edward Lutz, and many others, Stubbs' constitutional documents. All of these documents testify to a very self-conscious development of constitutional government in England under a monarchical form. This medieval view, derived from John of Salisbury and feudal law and the High Court of Parliament, and I use that term very advisedly, for it was a court. Incidentally, I might point out here that if the impeachment of Mr. Nixon should be voted by the House and should go to the Senate, we shall have being enacted in this country a replay of a great English principle, for the House of Lords has a judiciary committee which is a derivative of the old curia regis, which was the High Court of the King. And when an impeachment takes place and the trial is held, the Senate of the United States reverts back to the role of the House of Lords in English constitutional practice, and would, of course, try Mr. Nixon as it tried Andrew Johnson. This is one of the few places where the old English feudal practice came over practically intact into the present federal constitution. Now, when the colonies were founded, no matter whether they were inhabited by Germans, English, Scotch-Irish, French Huguenots, Quakers, whatnot, Anglicans, Presbyterians, the charters of these colonies were directly reflective of this whole medieval and Reformation and early modern English constitutional development. So that if you have the Congregationalists in New England, the Huguenots in Carolina, the Anglo-Saxon in Virginia, the Scotch-Irish in North Carolina, South Carolina, the Quakers in Pennsylvania, you have all of these groups living under charters granted by the King and Privy Council, which reflected in a miniature way the prevailing government of Great Britain. I would simply reflect for you upon the charters of the Virginia Company of 1606, 1609, 1612, 1618. I would reflect for you upon the famous Massachusetts Bay Corporation Charter, or its predecessors, the London Company Charter of 1606, the Plymouth Company Charter of 1606, the charter to the Carolina Colony of 1663, the charter to Connecticut, and so on, the grants given to the other colonies, even in the case of New York, when it became a royal colony. Now, in every instance, when these colonial charters passed from the hands of trading companies, as in the Virginia Company, for one, or others, and when they became royal colonies, as most of them did, or in the case of Connecticut and Rhode Island and Massachusetts, when they remained a type of charter colony, these charters remained intact. The form of the colony of Virginia did not change in government after 1625. Thus, each of the 13 colonies became 13 miniature British republics, or if you would, in some of them, monarchies. Virginia has been called by Alexander Bruce the first republic in the New World, and there was some reason for that. Because in many ways, Virginia became almost self-governing, in spite of the fact it was a royal colony. But the House of Commons in Virginia, or no matter what it was called in the other colonies, became a conscious attempt to reproduce the Commons of Great Britain in Williamsburg, in Newbern, in Charleston, in Boston, or in any other, Annapolis, any other colonial capital. They claimed the rights and the privileges of the parent commons in England. The governor took the place of the king. The Privy Council, or the advisors, the council to the governor, took the place of the House of Lords. So that the 17th century and the 18th century reflect this conscious attempt to put into practice on the colonial scene the government of Great Britain. This was not an accident. This was deliberate. And as I pointed out yesterday, these colonial charters require that the proprietors or the proprietary companies, or in the case of the charter colonies, the corporate colonies, that their laws must reflect and must be in harmony with the laws of the mother country. Which is to say then that the Reformation, political philosophy, and form of government prevalent in Great Britain, namely a limited or constitutional monarchy as was developing, was to be reflected in the colonies. And the colonies must consciously seek to reproduce in their own political life this very, very valuable inheritance. Now I'm inferring that this declined. How did it decline? I wish I had more time to simply explain to you the Puritan view. But the Puritans adopted the whole Reformation political philosophy, the modern attempt to deride the Puritans, to downgrade the Puritans, has no real historical foundation. Because the Puritans were very conscious of what they were doing. And as I tried to point out to you in regard to the history of law, so in the history of government, there is a Puritan tradition, if you would, a Puritan heritage, which was just as vital in Charleston, or in Williamsburg, or in Annapolis, as it was in Boston. So we may speak of a common colonial political heritage, both expressed in its jurisdiction, on the one hand, its jurisprudence, I meant to say, and the other hand, in its practice of government, in the way they elected people. The Puritans, and I'm speaking now of the whole American continent, the 13 colonies, more forcefully expressed in some than others, obviously, in Georgia, which was not founded until 1733 and 34, it was not expressed until a much later date. But in the rest of the colonies, this Puritan political philosophy was the dominant political thought. Now, what did it hold? What did the colonies receive from the English reformers? What did they receive from Geneva? What did they receive even, if you would, from St. Thomas Aquinas, although they changed his views accordingly? They received several very well-defined concepts. One, that government is ordained of God. Two, government receives its rightful powers from God. Government receives the areas of jurisdiction from God. There are certain areas which government may not enter. There are certain areas which it must enter. It is responsible for protection, both internal and external. Defense from enemies. It is responsible for maintaining justice. It is responsible for maintaining, as the founding fathers said in the Constitution, domestic tranquility. This they believed. And this they inherited. And this they wrote into their colonial charters and their colonial statutes. And I want to make now a very important point. In the great days of our political tradition, almost nothing was said about rights. The whole philosophy of rights is an extraneous introduction brought in largely by John Locke and brought onto the American scene by John Wise, who was arguing against Cotton Mather in the case that governed the churches of Massachusetts and Connecticut. The Puritans did believe in rights. They believed, as did Calvin, and as did others, in four basic rights. The right of life, as a gift of God, which we must live for His glory, as the gift of liberty, by which we must have the liberty to correctly and truly and freely worship the Lord God, as He has commanded us to worship Him. The right of property, in which and through which we express our stewardship, as has so well been brought to us by Professor Taylor. And the right of marriage. Now, however, the Puritans didn't say much about the rights, but they spoke at great length upon the obligations, the responsibilities, because our rights given to us by God are the product or are the result of the duties laid upon us by God. We have the right to life because God gave us life, and we must live that life for Him, and so on. We have the right to marriage because God has given us the duty of marrying, as He laid it upon Adam before the fall. The marriage predated the fall. Thus, the Puritans spoke at length upon duties and obligations and laid very little stress upon rights. And this was inherent in our colonial political tradition. Now, as I point out in the case of jurisprudence, it was hard to maintain. And John Locke made his entrance into American thought very early in the 18th century. Most notably through John Wise, as I said, who objected violently to Cotton Mather's attempt to bring the Congregational Churches of New England into a form of Presbyterianism, which he had come to feel would be the safeguard for doctrinal purity in Massachusetts and Connecticut. And John Wise of Ipswich wrote his famous two documents of 1710 and 1718, the cause of the New England Churches, the quarrel of New England Churches espoused, against Cotton Mather. And in order to ward off what he thought were the tremendous dangers of Presbyterianism, he brought in and sought to defend the principle of Congregationalism with a political philosophy which was totally alien to John Mather, to the founding fathers of the Massachusetts colony, because they wrote at length against the dangers of democracy. They very openly espoused an anti-democratic philosophy, and they were right, because they realized that there's entire incompatibility between Christianity and democracy. And, of course, they summarized the whole position in the famous question, if the people govern, who shall be governed? They were self-consciously opposed to democracy. And John Wise sneaked it in through the back door to espouse Congregationalism as over against the milder form of Presbyterianism, which the Mathers were espousing for the churches of Connecticut. But I do not mean to blame John Wise for the whole problem. In the 18th century, as Lockean political thought became much more popular in Great Britain because the Whigs used it. They used it to justify the revolution, the bloodless revolution against James II and the bringing in William and Mary, William of Orange. The English Whigs consciously used John Locke. And as the parliamentary system developed in the 18th century, more and more of the English governing class, and by that I mean the royal governors, who were sent over here, members of the Anglican clergy, particularly the Virginia, and men who ran the Admiralty courts, men who ran the military, these English officials of various degrees brought with them, to a great extent, Lockean political philosophy. And, of course, some colonists went to England to study law, to simply make the grand tour, and they became familiar with Lockean political thought. And it is at this point that we ran into serious trouble. And it is at this point, and certainly by 1776 and probably before then, that the whole English colonial political Puritan tradition was thrown into jeopardy. Now, I cannot go into all the reasons for it, except to say that partly because of what Professor Taylor gave us in brief this morning, namely, the Seven Years' War, the rise of a tremendous national indebtedness. England, at the end of the Seven Years' War, reversed its traditional policy toward the country, toward the colonies. Up until 1763, they had governed the colonies with mercantilism, which, whatever its faults may have been, I'm not here to debate the merits or lack of merit of mercantilism, because there's a great deal of debate upon it. The colonies did not object to the mercantilistic system. They did not object to taxation under the mercantilistic system because the taxation was for purposes of control and not for raising revenue. And this is a very important distinction because it lies at the very heart of the constitutional issue. As Professor Taylor's well brought out, the Seven Years' War brought England to a very serious situation. The per capita national debt in England had risen alarmingly. The interest on the national debt had risen alarmingly. And the English felt they'd fought a war for the benefit of the colonies, and they were being allowed to pay for the colonies waxing fat. And they said this. The Gentleman's Magazine of London said, why should Great Britain fight a war for the colonies? And why should the colonies profit from our war? Our men bled and died, our pocketbooks are suffering, and the colonies are every day waxing fat. And then it went on to a long, dolorous type of thing, and England is manifestly sinking. Well, in 1763, the situation, of course, was a victory in the Treaty of Paris. But the Treaty of Paris was very unpopular, and the Prime Minister resigned in order to ward off criticism of the newly arrived monarch, George III. And a new Prime Minister came into power, Lord Granville, who, as one American historian has said, regarded red ink in the British Treasury as a signal from the devil that something should be done. And he loathed red ink. And he determined to take all the red ink in the British Treasury and make it black ink by the simple process of having the colonies pay for the war, which was easier said than done. But you have to understand this constitutional background. In its opening problems, the approach to the American Revolution was really a question of how England could apply the British imperial, the British constitution of an island kingdom to a colonial situation. Now, Athens had tried this and failed. Rome had tried this and failed. England was going to try it once more. But written into the English constitution was the old feudal statement, so popular today. No taxation, no representation, no representation, no taxation. You cannot tax the colonies unless they're represented. That is, wait a minute, tax them for revenue. You see, under the feudal law, the king could not ask for a gracious aid without the consent of first the feudal barons, which became parliament. He could ask for what they called feudal aids, but feudal aids were very restricted. He could get a feudal aid without any question, without asking parliament, for the knighting of his oldest son. He could get for the marrying of his eldest daughter. Poor Pop, he paid the bill then as now. And so he had to foot the bill, and so he could call upon his vassals to come to his aid. If he got captured going on a crusade, and the Turks were modern enough to demand a ransom, then they had to pay the bill. This happened in the case of Richard of England, when he won the crusade, and they had to dig him out. And for about 30 days a year, the king could command his vassals to supply troops. I would remind you that we're operating on the basis of a thesis. A thesis he first enunciated by James Orr in a great work called The Christian View of God and the World, in which he declared that he who believes truly that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, commits himself to much else beside, to a view of God, to a view of man, to a view of sin, to a view of redemption, to a view, and I'm telescoping his words, to all of culture. That means history, government, economics, and all that man does. And this is the basic thesis in which I'm presenting these lectures. I pointed out to you last time that the war between the states marked the beginning of the great decline in American constitutional government. It opened the way for the popularization of Darwinism on the one hand, and following closely upon that fact concurrently. It allowed the Constitution to be used for non-constitutional purposes. But to be specific, it was the first instance in which the Constitution was reworked in order not to be a Constitution, but to be really an arm of legislative enactment. That is, to use the Constitution for purposes of political, social, or economic reform, which did not basically belong in constitutional frame of reference. I pointed out to you last time that Darwinism made tremendous inroads on American Now what happened? And this is the key point. After 1770, the colonists gave up the attempt to oppose British policy in terms of British Constitution. Now, why did they? Very frankly, they could not justify a separation from England or a revolution in terms of the British Constitution. Now, you say, Singer, are you not very pro-British? No, I'm very pro-law. Frankly, the colonists were right in saying this. There is absolutely no justification for the American Revolution in terms of the constitutional struggle. Because I'm not saying that Parliament had not made mistakes. They had. But they were not irreconcilable. They were not irrevocable. They were errors, and they were violations of the Constitution. But not one real English right was being threatened. They were not threatening the lives of the colonists. And even some of the expenses incurred had been incurred to defend the colonists, because in the 7 Years' War, after the early battles, after Braddock's defeat, for instance, Virginia did not contribute 1 cent to fight the war. The Pennsylvania Assembly finally agreed to help by a very curious demand when the legislature, the Assembly, passed a bill to provide grain. And it was really intended to provide a seed grain for corn, wheat, and so on. But some of the clever boys interpreted it very liberally. Instead of providing seed grain, they provided grains of powder. South Carolina, after initial threats, didn't contribute. North Carolina contributed nothing. New Jersey contributed nothing. So that when England tried to get the colonies to help in the 7 Years' War, after French danger was over, the colonies said, oh, no, that's your war. You're fighting in Europe. You're paying for it. You just take us on, too. Then they would not cooperate. And after the war, in Pontiac's conspiracy, the English did send over 10,000 troops, not to grind down Massachusetts, but to defend Massachusetts from Pontiac, because Massachusetts wouldn't. Pontiac had hatched a big conspiracy to capture every post from Lake Superior over to Lake Ontario, and that he came awfully close to being successful and wiping out the frontier. As a result, Massachusetts, the other colonies, did nothing. And so finally they sent Gage over with 10,000 men to protect their investment in the colonies. It was expensive. Now, I'm not trying to draw a picture that the English were right. Lord North was stupid. He was extremely stupid. And he was hard-headed. And George III was not England's most brilliant king by a good bit. But nevertheless, they had a real point. The real problem was how to tax the colonies in such a way that they would not violate the British Constitution and yet get some money to meet the financial needs. After 1770, the colonies simply surrendered on the basis of a constitutional argument and adopted a whole new argument. And to do this, they adopted John Locke, who had written his 2 treatises on government in 1690. Now, I wish I could give 5 lectures on John Locke, but I can't. Sufficient is to say that by the time of Leibniz, modern English rationalism had run its course. It had run into sheer irrationalism and tremendous disagreement. Descartes, according to his own profound and modest statements, had swept the decks clean of all previous philosophy, including St. Thomas Aquinas. Spinoza came on the deck and said, we'll have one more good sweep, and out will go Descartes. Leibniz came in and took the old philosophical broom and swept off Descartes, Leibniz, and as well as all the other rationalists. But Leibniz himself ran into difficulty. So what happened? English empiricism, beginning with Thomas Hobbes about 1650, broke in on the scene. And Hobbes wrote to justify despotism as a doubt. Locke, in 1690, wrote many famous books, but the one I'm dealing with are his 2 treatises on government, in which he applied a British empiricism, an empirical epistemology, and the resultant of metaphysics to get the problems of government. Now, very briefly, John Locke held that the minds of tabula rasa, there are no innate ideas. By implication, there's no innate consciousness or moral conscience. That all we learn through the senses. Now, he got this from the Stoics. He also got from St. Thomas Aquinas in a different context. Locke's famous statement from St. Thomas was, Nihil est intellectu sine primum in sensibus. Translating into English is this, that there's nothing in the intellect which does not first originate in the senses. Now, in the realm of psychology, this leads directly to Freud, to B.F. Skinner, and all the other idiosyncrasies of our day in which psychology wanders and wanders badly. It also leads to other very dubious modern theories. It also led to Karl Marx, incidentally. It led to many of our modern political, social, economic problems. Because if this is true, then there is no objective truth. Now, Locke logically leads to materialism, and he did in Marx. Now, from our point of view, what I want to do today is, and I cannot finish, I don't intend to, is to apply this to the American problem. Locke held politically that men are possessed of certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and property. And that in order to safeguard these rights, mankind, at some unknown time in the future, entered into a social compact. And as a result, government emerged to safeguard these aforementioned rights created and affirmed by the law of nature. Thus, he came to his next conclusion that all government exists by the consent of the governed. And when any government breaks the compact by failing to live up to the duties imposed upon it by the governed, then revolution is justifiable. Now that's Locke in its simplest form. And I admit that it's very simple, but I'm doing it for the sake of time. Now, I want to examine Locke for a minute. If, or since he held, that all you learn through your senses, you cannot possibly say, now, I want to examine Locke for a minute. If, or since he held, that all you learn through your senses, you cannot possibly say that man has any rights. It's absolutely logically, epistemologically impossible. Let me show you why. You cannot smell a right. You can't taste a right. You can't feel a right. And you can't hear a right. You tell me how you can. What does a right taste like? Chocolate ice cream or beefsteak or onions? Does it sound like Beethoven or a crashing of a tray? Secondly, you cannot affirm that these rights are inalienable. How do you know that something is inalienable if all you know about, you know, through the combination of one or more of your five senses? You can't know a thing. See, Locke is totally irrational. And he's historically wrong. There is absolutely not one whit of historical evidence for any such thing as a social compact. The original one. And, of course, lastly, he is totally unbiblical when he holds that government exists by the consent of government. But that's exactly what it doesn't do. What I'm showing you is that democracy as a political philosophy is irrational, it is contradictory, it is unbiblical, and it is the vestibule to despotism. And people equip or equate democracy and Christianity, neither understand Christianity nor democracy. They have no comprehension of the implications of John Locke. Because John Locke's final conclusion was that revolution is justified when the majority so decree. Which, of course, denies the government any possibility of permanence or stability. The French have applied to John Locke more numerously than any other country in modern Europe. And the French now are reaping the harvest of their dedication to John Locke. The ultimate conclusion of John Locke, of course, is Karl Marx, who very openly admitted his debt to John Locke, particularly in two phases, which I shall use later. Now, do you see what happened? Locke was the apostle of democracy. He was seized upon by Thomas Jefferson. And the Declaration of Independence reflects in its three parts the whole Lockean philosophy. Its preamble is based upon John Locke, with one very important change. Jefferson said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal with certain inalienable rights," and he changed property to the pursuit of happiness. Now, of course, Jefferson's statement of self-evident truth is simply not true. There is no such thing as a self-evident truth. Do you not agree with that, Professor Taylor? There is no such thing as self-evident truth. Because to be self-evident means to be evident to itself. Now, truth resides only in the person of Jesus Christ. There is in him the self-evident truth because he is God, in whom the fullness of truth resides. But for us, there is no self-evident truth. Strike out the first sentence in Jefferson. Strike out the rest. But note the immediate decline of Locke in Jefferson. The right to private property is gone. The right to the pursuit of happiness is inserted. Already, the inherent weakness in Locke is coming out in Jefferson. It's a very important point already. Already, it's coming out. Now, I should say this, and you may not like this, that Jefferson was a materialist. He was tremendously influenced by French philosophers. Condorcet, Condillac, Holbach, Helvetius, and the materialist school, which produced the philosophical frame of reference for the French Revolution. Now, he had not been to Europe, but he spent many days in Raleigh at the tavern, and there he had imbibed radical theism from the English governors, who also imbibed other things at the tavern, and so did Jefferson. They did it together while he was at the law school at William and Mary, not the university. So that Locke offered to the colonists a seeming justification for a revolution that they could not justify in terms of the American Revolution and in terms of the British Constitution. Now, let me show one interesting point. In 1774, John Adams, who was acutely aware of the dangers of Locke, and yet who also held that Britain was violating the Constitution, and they were, offered a plan for a quasi-parliamentary imperial rule in which there would be a parliament in this country and to cooperate with the parliament in Great Britain, and for an act to be effective in the colonies, it must have the acceptance of both the parliament in Great Britain and the parliament in this country. 160 years later, with all due pardon to my friend, England finally got around to accepting John Adams in the famous Dominion Statutory Act in 1931. John Adams finally came to his own long after he was dead. But that act is almost a reproduction of John Adams's statements and his proposals, which he made in an effort to solve the problem. John Adams was not really a revolutionary. He was very fearful of it. He was strong for constitutional rule, but he was very fearful for revolution, very fearful. And he entered it only half-heartedly, which explains a very important point in the American Revolution. Many of the finest people in the colonies remained Tories. And another great group, including John Dickinson, John Rutledge, Hugh Williamson, John Adams, and others, Robert Donald Livingston, to mention but a few more, Roger Sherman, only very reluctantly joined the revolution. And John Jay made it very clear that he joined the revolution only for one purpose, and that was to control it. And in this, he was joined by John Adams, who decided, as did John Rutledge and John Dickinson, that they would join the movement simply to prevent it from becoming radical. You may not know this, but John Dickinson refused to sign the Declaration of Independence. He refused to sign it. He has yet to sign it. Not because he was afraid, because he later became an officer in the Revolutionary Army, but because he objected to Jefferson, and very strongly. He was very much afraid of the revolution. Now, what I'm saying is this, that in its implications, the American Revolution was a radical movement. And this is exactly what Jefferson wanted. Jefferson advocated at one time in his life a letting of blood every 30 years, a revolution every 30 years. And he coined the famous phrase, "The tree of liberty flourishes only in blood." When he got president, he changed that. He didn't want to have a revolution. So it was about time for one when he became president. He thought perhaps the time should be postponed. But in his theoretical writings, this is what he argued for. He was a real radical. And so was Franklin, although perhaps not quite as radical in this respect as Jefferson was. So that the Tories, who men like Joseph Galloway, for instance, these men had a real point in their refusal to join the revolutionary cause. It was partly the radicalism inherent in Locke. It was partly due to the fact that they said there was no reason for separation from Great Britain. Now, curiously enough, in 1866, in a speech which he gave in support of the Civil Rights Bill of 1866, and which Johnson was going to veto, Thaddeus Stevens let the cat out of the bag. He openly declared, and he was a radical of radicals, he openly declared that there was not one justification for the American Revolution except for the desire of the colonists to found a radical democratic government. You can find that in the Congressional Globe for 1866. I think it is July 1866, when the struggle between Johnson and Congress was reaching height. And Johnson was vetoing. He told he was going to veto. And so Thaddeus Stevens got his opening guns in. And he said, why then did the colonies revolt? Because they had wanted to establish a radical democracy. And then he wanted to say that this had been thwarted by the Philadelphia Convention. And they had put chains, the most shameful chains in history, around liberty. They had done away with the revolution. And he was right in the sense that they'd done away with the revolution. This was true. And then he had said this. He said, I had long hoped that the late war, the war between the states, would be the means of totally undoing those shackles. In other words, he wanted to use the war as a means of destroying the Constitution. This was the real goal of the radicals, not merely to punish the South. They did have that in mind. But beyond that, they wanted to do away with the Constitution. And Stevens, this is why he hated Johnson so. Because between the radicals and their goal stood the lone, stalwart character of Andrew Johnson, who was thoroughly aware of what they were up to, who knew more about them than they knew about themselves. And this is why his messages to Congress are such jewels of constitutional law. Now to go back. With the American Revolution, then, you have a conflict between the political philosophy of the Renaissance on the one hand and the political philosophy of the Reformation on the other. And this set up a conflict in American history, which is ever with us. And you have seen the last 40 years the gradual and sometimes the hasty decline of the philosophy of constitutionalism as the waves of democratic philosophy beat up against the foundations of that government and washing out to sea. This is what's happening. In other words, between constitutionalism, which is a product of Calvin's Reformation at its height, and its English counterparts, and democracy, there is absolutely no possible compatibility. And as I said yesterday, Marshall summed it up and said, we are governed of law and not of men. And he well knew of where he spoke. And he wasn't just saying it then. He repeated this idea in McCulloch versus Maryland. He repeated it in other great Supreme Court decisions. Because Marshall was very conscious of what he was doing. I had better close, I think, at this point today. I shall resume on Monday.